Welcome back to Academic Agent Retrospective. This is part 7. And today we're going to be covering a lesser known series called Econ Shots, which aired in the spring and early summer of 2020. It came out every Sunday, and it was a very short video, less than 5 minutes, about some moment in economic history, and I would explain why that had happened. The only trouble was is that basically nobody watched it. You can see from the viewing numbers here that Econ Shots consistently performed very poorly. Despite the fact that many people claim that they were a fan of the series, the revealed preference, to use an economic term, showed that nobody watched it. So after 14 weeks of this, I decided to cancel Econ Shots after 14 episodes. Anyway, as you'll see, I mean, the production values on Econ Shots were quite high. I used, I'm subscribed to various stock footage companies. I don't use them that often, but I thought I'd use full use of the stock footage on this one. So, but yes, for whatever reason, they failed to take off. Just to remind you, there is a promotion going on at the academic agency to tie in with this retrospective series. If you use the code RETRO, you get £100 off any of the bundles being sold. And yes, so hope you make use of that. Otherwise, let's take it away. For the first time ever, you can watch all 14 episodes of Econ Shots back to back. From the 1930s to 1986, the USA had a government agency known as the Civil Aeronautics Board. It served as a cartelizing device, in other words, a monopolizing device. The CAB was lobbied for by the big airlines. It was essentially staffed by people from the big airlines. The idea was to exclude competing airlines and to assign monopoly routes and also to regulate the rates so the rate would keep on going up and up. For example, only Eastern Airlines could do the New York to Boston route in those days. If anybody else tried to fly from New York to Boston, they would be severely prosecuted. In any case, they would not even be allowed to take off from the airport in the first place. In other words, they were considered illegal. They were excluded by the CAB. The CAB gave certificates of convenience and necessity to any airline on the route. If the CAB said you could not fly on the route, then you could not fly on it. There was no free market, no free enterprise in the airline industry. At one point, Pan Am had the entire Pacific locked up. All routes to the Pacific had to be flown by Pan Am. A similar cartel operated internationally and involved such national airlines as British Airways, Air France, and Russian Aeroflot. It was called the International Airline Transport Association, a body that still exists today, although it has been greatly weakened. At one time, it had a lockup on all European flights through an explicit price-fixing cartel, which was backed by law in every country. Such was the grip of the IATA's cartel that at one time it was more expensive to fly from London to Frankfurt than from New York to London. During this period of intense cartelization, the airline industry had a rationing situation. The CAB or the IATA assigned routes and excluded everyone except one or two airlines on each route. Those airlines locked up the most profitable routes and inflated the price of tickets. The airline industry in America was deregulated by Jimmy Carter in 1978, and finally the CAB was disbanded under Ronald Reagan in 1986. The price of tickets for domestic flights in America fell by over 50% from 1978 to 2013. The situation in Europe took longer, but the European Union finally put an end to the IATA's cartel through deregulation in 1992.
anyone who was around in the 1990s saw the benefits immediately, as new airlines such as Ryanair and EasyJet almost immediately capitalized to offer cheap and no-frills flights for a fraction of the price that any of the old corrupt companies were offering. From 1992 to 2017, European flights tripled. A family trip from Paris to Milan would have cost €1,600 in 1992, cost only €100 in 2017. When people use the word deregulation as a scare word, just remind them of all the flights they've enjoyed in the past 20 years. Now get out. For more than a century, the powerful De Beers Consolidated Mines, a South African corporation controlled by the Rothschild Bank in London, was able to organize an international cartel restricting the supply of diamonds on the market and raising the price far above what they would be at market levels. It is not simply that De Beers mined much of the world's diamonds. De Beers persuaded the world's diamond miners to market virtually all their diamonds through De Beers' central selling organization, the CSO, which then graded, distributed, and sold all the rough diamonds to cutters and dealers further down the road towards the consumer. One way it was able to maintain this was through the cooperation of the government of South Africa, who issued licenses for the right to mine and sell diamonds. This was made official by the Diamond Act of 1986 and the establishment of the Diamond Board of South Africa, which has persisted beyond apartheid and under the ANC. De Beers operated and still operates over 90% of the diamond mines in South Africa, and the other mining firms all sold their diamonds through the CSO. In short, the international diamond cartel was only maintained and only prospered because it was enforced by the South African government. There were severe sanctions against any independent miners and merchants who tried to produce quote-unquote illegal diamonds, even though they were mined on what used to be private property. The South African government has invested considerable resources in vessels that constantly patrol the coast, firing on and apprehending supposedly pernicious diamond smugglers. In the 1970s, it was announced that Russia had discovered considerable diamond resources. For a while, there was fear among De Beers and the cartelists that the Russians would break the international diamond cartel by selling in the open market abroad. But of course, the Soviet government was a professional monopolist itself and was all too happy to cut a deal with De Beers to receive an allocation of their own quota of diamonds to sell through the CSO. In fact, many of the companies that sold diamonds through the CSO had nationalized diamond mine industries. As we saw in the case of airlines, national governments like the fixed prices and guaranteed sales of monopoly licenses, and so De Beers realistically had the cooperation of many national governments, especially in Africa. All that changed in the year 2000 when De Beers itself announced that it would be discontinuing the CSO. Why? Why would the controller of the cartel ever decide to give up the cartel? The answer is that it was extremely expensive to maintain and administer. The 1990s had been a time of turbulent fluctuations in diamond demand, and maintaining a fixed price throughout that period proved very costly. It was also complicated by the fact that following the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russians did indeed end up flooding the market and breaking from the CSO. But for everyone else in the diamond market, the CSO had become almost like a central bank for international diamond producers, with De Beers often the buyer and seller of last resort. So it disbanded the cartel voluntarily. De Beers' market share in diamonds, which stood at 80% in 1990, had collapsed to 37% by 2018. Between 2011 and 2018, the Rapnet 1-carat polished diamond asking price fell by over 50%. Diamonds might be forever, but cartels are not. Now get out. The Robinson-Patman Act of 1936 is a United States federal law that prohibits so-called anti-competitive practices by producers, specifically quote-unquote price discrimination. It was designed to protect small retail shops against competition from chain stores by fixing a minimum price for retail products. The law grew out of practices in which chain stores were allowed to purchase goods at a lower price than other retailers. The landmark case was the Federal Trade Commission versus Morton Salt from 1948. The Supreme Court ruled in the FTC's favor. The commission had found that Morton Salt violated the act when it sold its finest blue label salt on a purportedly standard discount available to all customers, but which was only really available to five national chain stores that bought sufficient quantities of Morton Salt to obtain the discount price. The Supreme Court ruled, quote, "The legislative history of the Robinson-Patman Act makes it abundantly clear that Congress considered it to be an evil that a large buyer should secure a competitive advantage over a small buyer solely because of the large buyer's quantity purchasing ability." End quote. In actual fact, Morton Salt had a very clear pricing structure. The delivered price for a case of blue label salt was $1.60 if the customer bought less than one carload. It was $1.50 if they bought one carload. It was $1.40 if they bought 5,000 cases or more, with an additional 5 cent per case discount if they bought 50,000 cases in any consecutive 12-month period. While the Supreme Court ruling seems to suggest that the FTC were protecting some small mom-and-pop store from giants such as AMP and Safeway stores, in practice, less than 0.1% of Morton Salt sales of blue label cases shipped at the $1.60 price. The vast majority of customers bought 5,000 cases or more of the salt at the $1.40 price. One such customer, an example of the small business that the FTC was trying to protect, was National Retail Owned Grocers Incorporated, which had 18,917 retail stores but did not qualify for the 50,000 case discount because they did not order 50,000 cases. In fact, there is no evidence whatsoever that the discount caused any injury to AMP's or Safeway's competitors. But for the FTC and the Supreme Court, this did not matter. They punished Morton Salt merely for the theoretical possibility that this price discrimination might cause an injury to competition. They did not accept Morton Salt's perfectly reasonable argument that this loyalty discount for customers who ordered 50,000 cases or more saved them the costs of merchandising. Even besides that, it made excellent business sense to offer this discount from Morton Salt's point of view, since the 5 cent difference might have meant losing out on such large orders to their competition, namely other salt producers. But this did not matter because federal commissioners and judges imagined some small firm losing out because they were buying salt at 5 cents more. They said it was self-evident and obvious that the competitive opportunities of certain merchants were injured when they had to pay more for salt than did their competitors. Of course, it never once occurred to them that the bigger stores were buying substantially more salt, which they would have to sell to their own customers in order to make a return, or that in practice this 5 cent wholesale discount translated to only 1/5 of a cent per package of Blue Label table salt, which was what was being bought at the consumer level. If they based their retail prices solely on the per unit wholesale costs, AMP could not even charge a cent less for a package of salt than National Retail Owned Grocers Incorporated. But this did not matter to the FTC or to the Supreme Court. But such is the baffling world of antitrust law, and the Robinson-Patman Act has never been repealed. Now get out.
For 31 consecutive months, from October 1861 to March 1864, the Confederate Commodity Price Index rose at an average rate of 10% per month. In April 1865, when Robert E. Lee surrendered and the American Civil War ended, the index was 92 times its pre-war base. Why did this inflation take place? Quite simple. The Confederate States were funding their war effort by printing money and issuing government bonds, rather than via taxation. In January 1861, Southern forces took over the U.S. Mint at New Orleans and confiscated the bullion there. The gold formed the basis of the Confederate treasury, but it was a tiny reserve against the billions of dollars of Confederate currency they would print in the next year. The Confederacy tried to respond to the runaway inflation it caused by its own massive expansion of the money supply by instituting price controls. They had to keep revising the fixed prices upwards. For example, between May 1863 and May 1865, the fixed price of bacon went from $1 per pound to $4 per pound. Beans rose from $4 per bushel to a whopping $30 per bushel. These rapid increases in food prices produced riots throughout the Confederacy. In 1863, for example, in Richmond, Virginia, 1,000 people, mostly women, marched in protest towards food stores, and they simply loaded carts with flour, meal, and other provisions. Before long, there were widespread mob looting of shops for valuables. It ended with the mayor threatening to order the Confederate army to shoot at the rioters. We can take two lessons from this little episode. First, an increase in the money supply will always cause inflation. And second, price controls will never and can never work. Now get out.
Capital goods by definition evoke time, because you are not immediately consuming them. So the fact that we even have capital in society requires an understanding of time. All of our material wealth is a residuum of past activities. We stand on the shoulders of all those who came before, who sacrificed current consumption for future production. Right back to the first person who decided to spend time crafting a fishing net rather than catching a fish with their bare hands. Capital is transient. People are either accruing it or consuming it. It is not fixed or finite. It does not rest in certain hands forever. Capital is a way station in the production of consumer goods. A fishing net is a station on the way to producing fish for the next year until the net wears out. The net is eventually completely transformed into fish, and in that sense, used up, which is to say, consumed. The same thing is true of huge factories that are equipped with robots. The capital is not fixed in the sense of being there forever. They are eventually used up, consumed in the production of tins of tomatoes, automobiles, or whatever else. So, in effect, these robots in the factory, the capital goods, are half-baked cakes on the journey of being a fully baked cake, which is a consumer good. The robot and the factory are tins of tomatoes or automobiles or whatever else in their unfinished state. Eventually, they will be completely transformed into those consumer goods. The entrepreneur capitalist who commits to purchasing these half-baked cakes are making a bet for the next 20 or 30 years that people are still going to want to buy full cakes. In other words, the person who builds a factory is making a bet that people will want tins of tomatoes or cars for a long time, long enough for them to justify the expenditure on the factory and the robots. They are speculating that the market will persist long enough for them to see a return on their investment, which may not come to fruition for at least a year or 2 years or even 10 years. The workers who they employ in this factory not only benefit from being paid their wages today as opposed to in 1 year's time or in 10 years' time, but also benefit from the consumer goods which the factory will produce today that would not have been possible without the prior savings and investments that have been made in the capital goods by the entrepreneur capitalist. If the entrepreneur capitalist has bet correctly, then they will be rewarded for their speculation and their patience in waiting for the return. If they bet wrongly, then they will either come to ruin or else sell on the capital goods to another entrepreneur capitalist who can put them to more productive uses. Now get out. Ours is truly an age of statistics. In a country and an era that worships statistical data as super scientific, as offering us the keys to all knowledge, a vast supply of data of all shapes and sizes pours forth upon us. Mostly it pours forth from government. The overall statistics of the economy, the popular gross domestic product, data, that's GDP, that permits every economist to be a soothsayer of business conditions, come from government. Furthermore, many statistics are byproducts of other governmental activities. Income data from the tax office, unemployment data from the Labour Bureau, trade balance data from the customs offices, data on the money supply and banking from the central bank, and so on. And as new statistical techniques are developed, new divisions of government departments are created to refine and use them. We might also think today of demands from government for companies to keep employment and income data broken down by race and gender. The costs of compiling such statistics are often hidden. In 1956, the federal government employed over 10,000 people just to compile statistics. Today, that number is much bigger. There are 12 major federal government and statistics agencies, each of which has thousands of employees. The Bureau of the Census alone has 4,000 employees and a budget of nearly $4 billion. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has 2,500 employees and a budget of over $600 million. And there's another 10 of these major bureaus. But the great bulk of their data is coerced from private firms who must also employ people to collect and compile them to report to the government. In 1956, it was estimated that in the American utilities industry alone, it cost companies around $32 million to compile all of the data demanded by government. Today, one imagines the figure would be many times that amount. If you adjust the 1956 number for inflation, it is over $303.6 million. Statistics are the eyes and the ears of the bureaucrat, the politician, the socialistic reformer, the managerial elite. Only by statistics can they know, or at least have any idea about what is going on in the economy. Only by statistics can they find out about how many old people have rickets, or how many young people have cavities, or how many Eskimos have defective seal skins. And therefore, only by statistics can these interventionists discover who needs what throughout the economy, and how much federal money should be channeled in what directions. And certainly, only by statistics can the federal government make even a fitful attempt to plan, regulate, control, or reform various industries, or impose central planning and socialization on the entire economic system. If the government received no railroad statistics, for example, how in the world would it even start to regulate railroad rates, finances, and other affairs? How could the government impose price controls if it didn't even know what goods had been sold on the market and what prices were prevailing? Statistics, to repeat, are the eyes and the ears of the interventionists, of the intellectual reformer, the politician, and the government bureaucrat. Now get out. In 1463, King Edward IV banned the import of playing cards to England at a time when they were becoming popular across Europe. There was, of course, a domestic playing card market, and this total ban on foreign playing cards gave English producers an almost total protection. As an aside, Edward IV's daughter, Elizabeth of York, who married Henry VII, might look familiar to some of you. Historians have long noted how her portrait is strongly reminiscent of the Queen of Hearts in the English deck of playing cards. However, evidence for this is scant, since the Puritans under Oliver Cromwell destroyed most of the packs of cards in the country after they banned games of all kinds during the interregnum. However, today we're going to be focusing on the man that Cromwell would famously behead, Charles I. Despite the fact that foreign cards had been banned from the time of Edward IV, they still found their way into England, and the roaring playing card black market was undercutting the protected English producers. In fact, Charles's father, James I, instituted a special law requiring playing cards to be stamped with a special insignia, which would appear on the Ace of Spades, which later became known as stamp duty and was maintained for many years after the Restoration up until 1960. And this is why the Ace of Spades still has a more ornate design than the other aces. Anyway, the persistence of foreign cards being sold on the black market led the domestic playing card manufacturers to lobby Charles I into instituting a royal charter in 1628 and establishing the Worshipful Company of Makers of Playing Cards, which still exists today, by the way, and even has its own website, which you can see here. This was essentially a guild that was supposed to help protect the domestic card playing industry even beyond the absolute ban on foreign imports and James I's insignia stamp. But even after all of this, the haberdashers still managed to get supplies of cards from abroad, and the poor playing card makers, so ran the pathetic story, compelled to sell at low rates, could scarce get bread for their fainting bodies. In this extremity, they had cast themselves at the foot of the throne, and in 1637, His Majesty had graciously convenated under the Great Seal to buy a constant weekly proportion of good cards at specified rates, and to such of the company as were door windows, aged men past labour, or not able to maintain themselves, His Majesty, out of his princely goodness, had allowed a maintenance of his profits, for which the petitioners praised God and blessed His Majesty. The basic deal here was that Charles I was effectively investing in these card companies through fiscal stimulus in exchange for a cut of their profits, 36 shillings from the sale of every 144 packs of cards, or 3 pence per pack, which was estimated to give him a return of between 5,000 and 6,000 pounds a year. Quite a lot of money in those days. This suggests that around 480,000 packs of cards were sold every year. Now, what's quite interesting here is that the king was acting as a kind of proto-Keynesian. We see protectionism, we see fiscal stimulus, and state-backed monopoly. But because the king's finances were technically still private and not public, as Hans Hermann Hoppe has pointed out, we also see him acting as a kind of capitalist entrepreneur, speculating on the fact that the playing card market seemed quite buoyant in 1637 and demand looked set to stay so, at least until that rotter Cromwell got in. The very existence of the black market in itself was a sure sign of this. And Charles I was effectively investing to make a return. The divine right of entrepreneurs, you might say. Now get out. In business, there is a concept called economies of scale. A firm can make significant savings by operating at a larger scale and increasing their market share. And these gains are the most significant driver of mergers and acquisitions that we see on the marketplace. But not all mergers are created equal. Some mergers are horizontal, which would be the case, for example, if McDonald's bought Burger King. Now, although significant savings can be gained from this type of merger, there are limits to them beyond a certain size and scale. Bigger is not always better, which is likely one of the reasons why McDonald's have not tried to buy Burger King. But there is also a second type of merger called vertical integration. To stick with burgers, let's take the production of a simple consumer good, such as a cheeseburger, which involves the cooperation of many hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Here we are watching someone in the kitchen flip the burgers on a grill, and then dressing the burger with cheese, condiments, lettuce, and so on and so forth. But of course, the burgers come ultimately from cows on a farm, which must be processed into burger patties. The burger buns come from wheat, which must be processed into flour and baked into bread. Even the tomato ketchup involves quite a long and complicated process in production. And even beyond that, the machines necessary for the processing along the way in themselves need to be manufactured, including the burger grills and the toasters for the buns. And even beyond that, iron ore needs to be extracted from the ground. Now, McDonald's could, if they wanted to, try to get involved in this entire production line by buying up and merging with, vertically integrating, that is, all of the stages into their company. Now, one might imagine that this would give them all sorts of advantages, but the reality is that because they'd have to rely on internal pricing, and because their internal production lines would in effect only have one customer, McDonald's, it is in fact much easier, and not to mention cheaper, if they rely on specialization under the division of labor at each stage of the way, and paying the costs as a client rather than taking them all over themselves. In fact, if McDonald's did take over all of these processes, it would likely result in what we call diseconomies of scale, and they'd lose a lot of money, because now they'd be trying to work out how much steel to produce, how many bottles of tomato ketchup to make, how many cows are required, and so on, purely on the basis of burger sales. Whereas, as things stand at the moment, each of the individual producers in the supply chain considers the whole array of demand for steel, ketchup, beef, and so on. Hence, vertical integrations often represent diseconomies of scale. Now get out. During the 1980s, unemployment reached a peak of 13% in the UK, and in the popular imagination, this is because Mrs. Thatcher closed the mines. But in reality, this is not why Britain experienced such high unemployment during this period. To find the root cause, we need to go all the way back to 1906, when, in a typical act of buying the swing vote of a minority, the Liberal Party government of that time passed the Trade Disputes Act, which declared that trade unions could not be sued for damages incurred by strike action. This effectively put unions above the law as a privileged class. In F.A. Hayek's estimation, this act was the single biggest cause of Britain's economic decline in the 20th century. And I quote, "These legalized powers of the unions have become the biggest obstacle to raising the living standards of the working class as a whole. They are the chief cause of the unnecessarily big differences between the best and the worst paid workers. They are the prime source of unemployment. They are the main reason for the decline of the British economy in general. This was all compounded by the Coal Industry Nationalisation Act 1946, which made the government the sole employer of miners, and therefore the sole respondents to the unions. So if a union went on strike demanding more pay, the government could appease them by giving them the taxpayers' money. A look at the average weekly wage of a miner might be instructive. In 1945, a typical miner earned £2.73 a week. By 1950, this figure had risen to £7.72 a week, which is a 183% increase in 5 years. By 1960, the figure was £14.62, an 89% increase since 1950 and a 435% increase since 1945. By 1970, the figure was £28.72, another 96% increase in 10 years and 952% since 1945. And by 1980, the average miner's weekly wage was £114.47 a week, an incredible 298% nominal wage increase since 1970 and an increase of 4,093% since 1945. In other words, a miner in 1980 was paid 42 times more in nominal terms than their 1945 counterpart. They extracted these extra wages largely by going on strike and holding the country to ransom. In 1970 alone, over 10 million workdays were lost to strike action, both official and unofficial. For example, in 1972, the government offered the miners an 8% pay increase, and this was duly rejected, and the miners' strike caused an energy shortage and brownouts across the country under Prime Minister Edward Heath. In the end, after 6 weeks, the unions got their way and extracted another £116 million for their members, which was between a 17% and a 24% pay increase. And then again, in 1975, the miners went on strike again, led by Arthur Scargill, and extorted another £140 million, which resulted in another 35% pay increase for the miners. The basic weekly rate increased from £45 to £61 overnight. Scargill's response to the deal was to say much more could have been obtained. How did the British government pay for all of these massive pay increases? Well, of course, in that time-honoured Keynesian fashion, they did it simply by printing more money, which resulted in, of course, massive inflation, to the tune of 28% on the retail price index in 1973 and 18% inflation during the winter of discontent in 1977 and 1978. So the unions did not just hurt those people that they kept out of work through their exclusive membership and their monopoly on jobs like mining, they also hurt everyone in the entire economy through chronic inflation. And that's why we don't have a coal industry in the UK anymore. Now get out. During the 1970s, house prices in Palo Alto, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area, quadrupled, while the population fell and the number of children enrolled in schools fell by one-third. Not a single new house was built during the entire decade. In nearby San Jose, which is near Silicon Valley, in 1969, house prices were 2.2 times median family income. But by 1979, they were 4 times median family income. And in 1989, it was 5 times median family income. By 2005, 7.5 times median family income. The reason? California has some of the severest building restriction laws and land use restriction laws in the United States. Amazingly, Palo Alto pioneered so-called affordable housing legislation in 1973 by creating inclusionary zones. But to give you an example of how inclusive such zones are, consider that less than 7% of Palo Alto's police officers actually live in Palo Alto because they simply cannot afford to live there. Almost a quarter of them live right across the other side of the San Francisco Bay Area. A nurse on an average salary would have to spend only about 30% of their salary to pay for the mortgage on a two-bedroom apartment in Dallas, Texas, which doesn't have such punitive building and land use restriction laws. But they would have to spend over 75% of their salary to live in an identical apartment in Palo Alto. And this is just one of many reasons why Californians continue to migrate to Texas every year. The worst hit people in these areas, which like to promote themselves as champions of diversity and social justice and affordable housing, are of course the poorest. As an example, the black population of San Francisco, its poorest demographic, fell by 35% from 1990 to 2006. They were moving to places like Contra Costa County and Oakland, which then has a chain effect as white residents in those areas, perceiving those areas as in decline, move out. Contra Costa was 90% white in 1970, but it is now only 58.6% white. And you cannot assume that this is only because of racism. The crime rate in Antioch, Contra Costa County, is 48% higher than the national average. The crime rate in San Pablo is 78% higher than the national average. And the crime rate in Oakland, which is currently 36% white, 24% black, with the remaining 40% made up of mainly Hispanics and Asians, has a violent crime rate, which is 238% higher than the Californian average, 287% higher than the national average, while property crimes are 124% higher than the state's average. Your chances of becoming a victim of crime in Oakland are close to 1 in 14, so with those odds, you'd likely look to move too, if you could, no matter what your race happens to be. Oakland, of course, has been under California's disastrous rent control laws since the 1970s and sweeping housing reform laws which restrict the rights of landlords to evict tenants. Who could have possibly foreseen that it would become one of the most dangerous cities in America? They are, in effect, state-mandated slums. Even the New York Times described it as among the world's most dire places. Now get out. In March 1952, the office of the President of Uruguay was abolished and replaced with a nine-man council, each of whom held equal power. From 1919, Uruguay had embarked on a policy of extreme welfareism, including an enormously generous pension scheme. Workers were very difficult to fire. They were entitled to retire at the age of 55 after 30 years of service, or at the age of 60 after 10 years of service, and after paying around 17% of their salaries into a pension matched by their employer, they were paid their full final salary for their retirement. Employees received free medical care plus a guaranteed 20 days fully paid leave. Expectant and nursing mothers also received extra government benefits. By 1956, one in every three Uruguayan citizen was a public servant directly employed by the government. The government ran a 5 million pesos budget deficit, but their millions of employees kept agitating for more pay. For example, meat packers went on strike for a guaranteed daily allowance of 4 pounds of meat, well below market prices. By April 1963, Uruguay was practically bankrupt, but no politician would dare make any changes to the welfare system. Inflation was rampant, local production had collapsed, and unemployment was increasing. Strikes were endemic, and the perception of political turmoil had killed the tourism industry. The government repeatedly responded by instituting price controls and banned imports in order to try to boost domestic production, which led to widespread smuggling from Argentina and Brazil. Capital flight reached $50 million. The treasury now owed 700 million pesos to pension funds. The government deficit more than quadrupled to 807 million pesos. Workers in ongoing nationwide strikes were still demanding a 50% pay increase. By 1967, 45% of all Uruguayans were dependent on state handouts, including a large portion of people who had retired young at the age of 55. The cost of living increased by 88% in 1965, and then another 50% in 1966. The government responded by printing more money and granting wage increases as high as 60%. The cost of living had increased as much as 32 times in 10 years, while gross national product had decreased by 9% in the same period. By 1968, the country, still suffering from endemic strike action, experienced electricity brownouts after a 50% decrease in electric energy output. Out of a population of 2.6 million people, only 900 people were working. 300,000 were pensioners, and another 250,000 were unemployed, which was a 28% unemployment rate. The consumer prices increased by another 136% from 1966 to 1967, and from 1961 to 1968, Uruguay experienced 2,173% inflation. One US dollar would fetch you 11 pesos at the start of that period, but 250 pesos by the end. People at the time said that Uruguay had caught the English disease and a military dictatorship followed. The question remains in 2020 why the lessons of history are never learned. Now get out. In 1584, the Duke of Parma led the armies of the Spanish into Belgium and besieged the city of Antwerp. Food quickly became scarce, and so naturally prices rose sharply. The city fathers of Antwerp responded by instituting a strict price control. No merchant could charge above their specified price in the city on pain of severe penalties. The consequences of this policy were twofold. It was a long time before the Duke of Parma was successful in blockading the river Scheld to prevent ships laden with food. Corn and preserved meats might have been hurried into the city by the thousands of tons, but no merchant would run the risk of having his ships sunk by the Duke's batteries merely for the sake of finding a market no better than many others, which could be reached at no risk at all. If provisions had been bought at a high price in Antwerp, they likely would have been imported. As it was, the city, by its own stupidity, blockaded itself far more effectively than the Duke of Parma could have done. In the second place, the enforced lowness of prices prevented any sort of retrenchment on the part of the citizens. Nobody felt it necessary to economize, so the city lived in high spirits until the provisions ran out. In 1585, the city of Antwerp surrendered and was taken over completely by Spanish forces. From this, we can draw two principles. First, that rising prices encourage conservation of scarce commodities. In other words, controls encourage waste of scarce resources. Second, that rising prices bring forth increased supplies. In other words, controls diminish sources of supply. Now get out.
In early 1962, John F. Kennedy sent to Congress a draft of something called the Standby Capital Improvements Act, with a letter urging them to pass it as soon as possible. This was a proposal for Kennedy to spend $2 billion, the equivalent of $17 billion today,
on expanded public works programs whenever it looked like unemployment was about to rise. The idea was that projects would be designed quickly to create jobs by injecting said projects with federal money. In other words, printing new money to pay these unemployed people who are now in a public works scheme. Under Keynesian doctrine, this would help the economy by expanding consumer spending, although as we know, the real result of such policies is nearly always inflation. This was slow at first. The consumer price index rose by only 6.54% between 1960 and 1965, but then it snowballed to an increase of 23.5% between 1965 and 1970. But there was a political impact to this move too, because Congress was being asked to transfer a part of its power to the purse of the president. The president could now spend this extra money by fiat as long as he could point to the threat of impending unemployment. After some back and forth with the Senate, who added a special caveat that the president could only use it in areas where the unemployment rate has risen 1% over a 3 to 9 month period, and which had either median family income of $1,600 to $1,700, or twice the national employment rate. The House of Congress eventually passed this. The House Public Works Committee authorized the full $2 billion standby program with a $900 million immediate acceleration program. This meant that in the event of a recession in any state in the country, the president could act immediately by fiat without oversight from Congress. This gave Kennedy the power to declare a state of emergency for the area affected if he could show a 1% rise in unemployment and then release funds as if by magic for a public works scheme. In other words, automatic pump priming. Such public works schemes were typically in construction, the old classic building of bridges and so on. But construction workers in 1962 were paid $3.24 an hour when compared with an average of $2.36 an hour in all manufacturing and $1.71 an hour in retail trade. Assuming these emergency funds were spent on wages alone, at those rates, JFK could instantly employ about 1.5 million construction workers for a year around the country. But what would happen when the money ran out? Well, I mean, presumably they'd be unemployed again, and the unemployment rate would rise by 1% again, and that would trigger the act again, and so they could have their jobs back again. Out of 1,300 areas, only 345 were eligible for this, including all 54 Indian reservations and certain inner-city urban areas. So, in effect, this was a hidden emergency redistribution scheme whereby the president could be seen personally to inject money into a struggling area. And this was naturally part of the Democrats' Southern strategy to ensure the support of poor black voters in exchange for money, a kind of precursor for Lyndon B. Johnson's so-called War on Poverty. And as you can see from the 1964 presidential map, it worked. And as LBJ so famously said, we'll have those voting Democrat for the next 200 years. And so far, that strategy has overwhelmingly worked, as is so often the case with awful policies that appear to make no economic sense. Once you start looking at the political incentives, it's a lot easier to understand. Now get out. In the summer of 1959, the USA experienced a crisis in poultry farming. Specifically, there was a huge overproduction of eggs, which were selling below their cost of production. Overproduction in economics is another way of saying unsold. In other words, even selling below costs, the eggs were too expensive for most consumers in the economy, and millions of them went unsold. Pressure then grew on the government to do something about this, and so the Department of Agriculture agreed to increase the amount of eggs it purchased. It was already buying 500 million eggs, but now promised to commit to buying more. Of course, the fact that the government were buying all of these eggs in the first place was one of the chief causes of overproduction. The market would have allowed the adjustments to take place to bring overproduction to a halt, allowing some farmers either to go out of business or to downsize. But the politicians of that era considered this to be cruel, and so opted instead artificially to boost demand through direct government purchase. A second hidden reason for the cost price of eggs being so high at this time was that the government had also interfered with wheat farms during this era by providing subsidies for producers of grain and again making direct purchases. By June 1, 1959, President Eisenhower had piled up $3 billion worth of wheat. In today's money, that's around $26 billion. It was a supply equal to 2.5 times America's annual domestic needs for wheat. The storage, handling, and interest charges on this wheat cost the American taxpayers an additional $500 million. And the passed on costs to other producers was estimated to be in the region of $6 billion, or about $53 billion in today's money. Grain farmers were growing crops for government storage, not for the market, and the net effect of this policy was to keep the price of wheat artificially high to benefit the wheat farmers at the expense of everyone else. Everyone else included, of course, the poultry farmers whose chickens feed on grain. To make matters worse, knowing that most of this grain would just end up in some government warehouse, many farmers deliberately grew inferior quality wheat in order to take advantage of President Eisenhower's largesse. So the net result of Keynesian interference in agriculture during the 1950s was more expensive wheat at a worse quality than before, more expensive eggs, poultry farmers facing bankruptcy, millions of unsold eggs, as well as millions of tons of food wasting away in government warehouses. As was so often the case, though, these costs were hidden from the public, and the 1960 presidential election between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon saw both candidates falling over themselves to make yet more promises to the farmers, with Kennedy promising income parity for farmers in line with their urban counterparts and a system of mandatory production, while Nixon pledged to increase food prices even higher. The land of the free, ladies and gentlemen. Now get out.